It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedado. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Art of the Hustle is a production of iHeartRadio. You're listening to The Art of the Hustle, the show that breaks down how some of the world's most fascinating people have hustled and learned their way into achieving great things. I'm your host, Jeff Rosenthal, co-founder of Summit. And on today's episode, I had the pleasure to interview my friend Harley Finkelstein, COO of Shopify, Canadian entrepreneur, and just all-around great guy. We discussed his amazing journey from 2008, joining a small startup at Shopify, and then growing it to a publicly traded company with over 6,000 employees, $130 billion market cap, and over 1 million entrepreneurs operating stores on their platform. I was pretty blown away to learn how Shopify has maintained its culture over the last 14 years, its innovative and experimental edge even as they've achieved massive success, and how they've always seemed to be way ahead of the curve when it comes to channel partnerships, technology, and new resources for its user base. And just to simply get to know Harley better, who is honestly a role model for me in how he carries himself and how he approaches his work. So please enjoy my conversation with Harley Finkelstein. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I know that you must be, you know, slammed. The moment that we're in with the pandemic and COVID, and just, you know, I was reading some of the stuff you've been, you know, saying in public recently in the interviews you've been doing, just on the decade that we jumped in terms of, you know, bringing 2030 to 2020. I imagine that, you know, has a direct impact on the amount of work that you have on a daily basis.
Yeah, you think about e-commerce, so online commerce as a percentage of total commerce went from something like 5% in 2008 till like 15% in 2018. So it took about 10 years to get there. And we've basically have gone from 15% to about 25% in the last 10 or 12 weeks. So we've seen effectively a decade worth of conversion to digital commerce and retail in the last, you know, three, four months. And it's been dramatic. And frankly, what we see is it's sort of a tale of two worlds. And you can use this lens for not just retail, but you can use it for entrepreneurship or business in general. You see a resiliency on one side, and you see a reluctancy or a resistance on the other side. Some retailers and businesses have been resistant to change, and they have floundered, and they've suffered some really tough times. And others have just become incredibly resilient and have changed their business for the better indefinitely.
Yeah, this is one of the things that Simon Sinek was actually talking about on the podcast. Those that survive are the ones that can pivot their way out of it. It's just an incredible moment in time. And you know, we've been friends now for, I guess, close to a decade. You started Shopify 2008, correct?
The story of the company actually goes back even further. It goes back to around 2005 or so, actually 2004. Toby had moved from Germany to Canada for the best reason possible, because he met a girl who's now his wife. came to Canada as a new immigrant, wasn't able to work because he didn't have, you know, any type of working papers. And so someone had told him that the only way he can make some money would be to start a business. And being a German immigrant coming to Canada, presumably like where it's pretty cold relative to where he comes from, he decided he wanted to sell snowboards on the internet. And when he began to look at how to sell a product online back in 2004 or so, there were really two ways to do so. One way was you would post it on a marketplace like an eBay or an Amazon or an Etsy, something like that, which it was inexpensive, but did not allow you to build a real business. It was almost like you were renting customers from that marketplace. But the other way was, you could build an online store. You could use SAP or Oracle or Magento or one of these sort of big enterprise pieces of software. But that was like $1 million to do. Mm-hmm. And so disappointed with that, with those options, he just wrote a piece of software to sell his own snowboards and created this snowboard shop called Snow Devil. And very quickly, he realized that a lot of people like me wanted to use the software to build their own businesses. My sort of introduction to Toby was actually through my becoming what is now one of Shopify's first customers. I had a t-shirt shop that I launched around 2006. So just to sort of jump around a little bit. So I was born in Montreal in Canada. I grew up in South Florida, Boca Raton. I went to school there as a kid. And then because I was born in Montreal, my sort of the equivalent of in-state tuition at McGill University was like $1,800 a year. Mm-hmm. Which was just incredibly, you know, from a bang for buck perspective, was amazing. So I ended up going to McGill for undergrad, and I was 17 when I started and started a little t-shirt business selling t-shirts to universities, and that was a way to support myself. And at a certain point in undergrad, a mentor of mine convinced me to go to law school, not to become a lawyer, but rather to become a better entrepreneur, to become an entrepreneur. He sort of looked at law school as finishing school. And actually, he was completely right about that. And this particular mentor just happened to be teaching at the University of Ottawa. So I applied to one school, moved to Ottawa, had no friends, met Toby. He was transitioning out of snowboards into software. And I said, hey, I'd love to start a t-shirt business that would run concurrently while I'm in school. And I set up a t-shirt shop online and then realized there's no way I was going to practice law for more than, I think I lasted 10 months, and then called Toby in 2008 and said, I'm done. I want to come join you and a handful of other engineers. I was sort of the first non-engineer and helped build this great company called Shopify. And that was over a decade ago.
Law school is the finishing school. None of my mentors would have said that. I am not that type of entrepreneur because I'm not really that organized. You know, I'm very dependent on folks like yourself who can be a chief platform officer, a COO. I'm desperate for folks like that around me. Yeah. I'm curious, like, was that already, were these characteristics that have ended up, you know, leading you to be able to lead this organization through its stages of growth?
Young Harley had a ton of energy and probably was a ball of untapped potential. I talk about my first real business being, you know, this t-shirt business at McGill that made, you know, promotional t-shirts for universities, but that's not actually completely true. The truth is my first business was a business I started back in probably 1996. I was, you know, 13 years old and I wanted to be a DJ. And I know you DJ, and I know that, or you're around DJs a lot, I should say. I
DJ the situational tunes. Okay. I'm a big playlist designer.
Well, I say that because I actually follow you on Spotify, and so I wasn't sure if you would self-identify as a DJ or not, but you certainly are into music. I know Brett actually is a DJ now.
You nailed it.
And so. I want to be a DJ. I thought it was a really cool thing to do. Like most other 13-year-old Jewish kids, I went to bar mitzvahs and I saw these DJs and I just thought they were the coolest thing in the world. Not because of they looked a certain way, but because it felt like they were creating energy from nothing. They were able to put on a particular sequence of songs, and those sequence of songs would lead to a dramatic change in energy. That they can take 300 people that are sitting down in tuxedos having some rubber chicken at some, you know, some hall or some synagogue, and 10 minutes later can have every single person having a tie around their head, just freaking out and dancing and having the time of their life. And I thought that was such an interesting energy shift. That was such an interesting way to, such an interesting thing to do. And I just wanted to be a DJ. So I called around a bunch of DJ companies and said, hey, you know, like I'm 13 years old. I don't know much about DJing, but I'd like to learn. And of course they said, you know, get lost. And so I decided that I would start my own DJ company. And I should say one of the lenses that I should tell you is that I'd always been very enterprising. But one thing that my parents didn't have very much money, but one thing my dad in particular did was every single crazy little business idea that I had, no matter how dumb it was, he would make me business cards with my name on it and that business name. And so from a very early age, I always felt like even though these things, some cases never made any money or they were not profitable, my dad always made me feel like they were real. And so I started this DJ company, ended up that year moving from Montreal to South Florida, ended up DJing like 500 bar mitzvahs between like 13 years old and 17 years old. And that was really my first sort of business. And it didn't make that much money. I think, you know, the equipment cost me a lot. I had to pay staff and stuff, but it was a great entrepreneurial experience. So I was always very entrepreneurial. And then when I got to McGill, it was 2001. My dad had just, my parents never had a lot, but they lost everything in sort of that sort of post 9/11 couple of months, and mm-hmm. they had no money. My mom actually called and asked me to move back down to South Florida. And if you or any listeners have ever been to Montreal in the summertime, it's just the most amazing, magical place. It's sort of a mix of Europe and has this great kind of vibe to it. The French Canadian vibe almost has a Latin feel to it. It's an interesting place. And I was not going to leave Montreal. And so I just told my mom that I will figure it out and I will support myself and I will help support them if I could. And I ended up building this t-shirt business, making t-shirts for universities around Canada. And so I don't think I was ever particularly organized, but I sort of always had this insatiable growth mindset, this insatiable desire to learn, to build, to do stuff that I felt a lot of meaning around. The reason that this particular suggestion of going to law school was so interesting to me was because it actually, in hindsight, is exactly the advice I would give someone today. If someone today said, what would prepare me to run a company of the size of Shopify? Shopify, you know, is almost $100 billion company, depending on what day you look. So we're one of the largest companies, certainly one of the largest tech companies on the planet, but also one of the largest companies on the planet. I would say that law school was far more instructive and was far more valuable to me than something like, I also went to business. I did a joint law MBA. Business school was not instructive, was not helpful. It was all pedagogical. It was all case studies. But law school taught me how to write. It taught me how to think. It taught me how to debate. Something as simple as being able to read, you know, 1,000 pages and pick out the one single line that is the most important line. They call it the ratio decidendi in sort of Latin. But that's the most important. That's the crux of the entire thing. That is a skill that I never learned really up until law school. And so it was really valuable for me.
Well, and we know so many stories of founders that don't have that skill set who, you know, lost on a technicality or, you know, signed a deal or negotiated something, but didn't do this type of review for themselves right. and ended up paying the price. So I imagine when you, you know, joined Shopify and in those early, early years and, you know, started, you know, helping lead the organization, I imagine that was a really valuable skill set to bring to the co-founders.
In 2010, we raised our first round of financing. It was a Series A. It was led by Bessemer, by Jeremy Levine, who's still on our board, who's one of the most important people in my life professionally. He's just been a huge mentor, and he's been a great board member for us. But we didn't have a CFO at that point. And I think Toby and I sort of looked at the docs. And I think what law school gave me was it didn't necessarily give me a playbook on how to do a Series A financing, but it gave me the confidence that I would be able to figure out, okay, what exactly is this? What is a liquidation preference? How do I look this up? How do I explain it in a way that makes sense? And so that I thought was really valuable. And same sort of thing. I mean, the things that we raised our Series A in 2010, we took the company public, both in New York and Toronto, a dual listing in 2015. And now, you know, we're over 6,000 people. One of the things that I feel strongly about is that a company like Shopify or any high growth company, the people that are leading have to requalify for their job every single year. And I think requalifying for your job every single year puts the onus on you as the individual that you got to always be better. If there is someone out there right now who's a better COO for Shopify, that person deserves the job. But I want the job. I'm willing to requalify for the job every year so that there is no way there is a better candidate out there than me. And the onus is on me to do that, not on Shopify to sift through or to vet me. And that's sort of what law school did for me was it gave me this this curiosity about exploring things on a much deeper level. And that's, it's been instrumental. And so I know that I'm sort of throwing shade a little bit at business school, but I just, especially in sort of a post-COVID world, especially when all these universities are going to a remote structure, I simply don't think that, I think you need to go to university or need to go to school to take the skills out of it, not because you were getting some sort of, you know, some sort of degree or piece of paper. I just, that's just not that valuable anymore.
Really, really appreciate you giving us that insight into the way that you think about this stuff. And to your point, you know, it's pretty rare where the founders and early operators of a startup pre-seed are the same guys around the time of the Series B financing or C financing or the bigger later stage financings, let alone once it's a publicly traded company with, you know, thousands and thousands of employees. I'm sure that there's been some major growing pains, but, you know, talk us through that a little bit, because I'm sure that you've learned a lot along the journey.
Yeah, it's what's cool about being in a place. So I'm 36 years old. I think you're around my age, maybe a couple of years younger, older.
I'm 35.
But, yeah. So I've spent over 10 years, over a decade at Shopify, which is, you know, like almost a third of my life. Mm-hmm. And there's something about being in a particular place for that long. And one thing I think that it does allow for is really, really high levels of context. I mean, you founded, but also have been running Summit for, I think, a decade as well, maybe more, right? Since 2008, you guys started something like that?
Well, and that's the counterpoint. I am still very involved in Summit and I have that cultural knowledge, but I am not the best guy to operate, you know, a mountain development operation. So that's why I'm so curious. Most of us who start these companies don't have the same skill sets to operate at scale. And that's something that gets lost. It's like as these companies scale and you add, you know, if you go from 10 to 50 people, you lose culture, let alone, you know, 50 to 5,000. So to have the founders in the positions, to have early leaders in the positions that you guys have, I'm certain has a huge impact on the culture.
So you're absolutely right. So on the context side, one, it means that just like you with Summit, I have a really, really great understanding of every aspect of Shopify. And that is, so right now Shopify has, you know, we're, you know, over 6,000 people. We have over 1 million stores on the platform. If you were to aggregate our stores just in the US, for example, Shopify, we're not a retailer, but if you pretend for a second that we are a retailer, we would be the second largest online retailer in America. There'd be Amazon and then Shopify. And then like after that, you'd see eBay and Best Buy and Home Depot and Walmart.com and all those. But Shopify is the second largest online retailer in aggregate. And I think what comes with that is we have a lot of different areas of our business. We have a capital business. We've given out like over $1 billion worth of cash advances. We have a payments business. We have a logistics business, a shipping business. We have a physical retail business, Shopify Point of Sale. And that's just a slice of it. One of the benefits of being at a place for a very long period of time, if you're curious about that place and you have a real, and that place is something that you deeply care about, as it is for me, and I know it is for you with Summit, you do get a benefit in that you sort of know exactly, you're able to navigate the company in a much more, in a much better way, in a much more effective way. However, the key to it, I think, has always been know what our strengths are, know what our weaknesses are. We like to hire people at Shopify for their strengths, not their lack of weaknesses, which we've said publicly, and that's something that is fairly well known. So you often have these like strength finder diagrams where you sort of see, they kind of look like stars almost, like people are very strong here, but very weak in other places. We're okay with people having weaknesses. In fact, in some cases, big weaknesses, as long as our strengths are make them really, really unique. And so that's something we use as a hiring metric or hiring vector, but we also think about it internally. I'm actually not a very organized, I'm not a detail-oriented person. I like the big picture. And so the people that work with me, I need them to be incredibly detail-oriented because that's just not my skill set. On the flip side, if there's a particular area of the business that I simply don't think I have requalified to run. So if you take, you know, any area of our business, at the beginning, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a founder, I'm a startup guy. I love the early days of stuff. But a particular perspective, I need to hand that off to someone who's better suited for it. We one of the things that I am most proud of at Shopify is building Shopify Plus, which is our enterprise product. And we have, you know, everyone from Kylie to Gymshark to Bombas to Allbirds to like a ton of the biggest DTC brands on the planet all use Shopify Plus. I was totally the right person to get that started, but at a particular point running a 200 or 300, you know, person effectively sales, marketing and enterprise product division wasn't for me. It's important, I think, that leaders know when they need to bring in someone else to help run that. And that I think is just self-awareness. I think self-awareness is probably the most important thing of, at least for me, has been the most important skill set to develop over time.
We'll be back with more Art of the Hustle after the break.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like when I look at, you know, the big sort of incumbent power players in any industry, typically really lack innovation. They can't really build like what's next, but they can copy it really fast. So if you look at like a Facebook and like, you know, the best features on Snapchat are going to be on Facebook as soon as they can do it, right? Or on Instagram or whatever. And you guys kept on succeeding. You kept on growing. You're making money, being experimental, being sort of front of the marketplace. I want to know why. Talk to us a little bit about that. I would love to understand what separated Shopify to make it so this was the culture there.
When you sort of look through the rearview mirror, things do look rosy. And certainly building an app store and a partner program, you know, a decade ago turned out to be a really great idea for a bunch of reasons that we can get into. But that actually came from a very simple decision, which is that we did not want to build everything for everyone. We wanted to create products that most people need most of the time. And back in 2010 or 2011, when really the partner program, we were just setting it up in the first place, we were building e-commerce software for small businesses that sold physical products online. And that was it. And so if you needed us to convert shoe sizes from American sizes to European sizes, yeah, maybe that's something that, you know, some people need some of the time or some people need most of the time, but that's not what most people do. Most people most of the time don't need that. And so instead of actually building out every feature under the sun, we said, well, what if we did this? What if we said Shopify is going to provide the use case, the product market fit for 80% of what everybody needs that wants to sell a physical product online in a small business context? And what if we allowed third parties to build that last 20%? What would happen? Well, the result of it is that one, these third parties can now build something and they can make real money. They can create, we can create more value for them than we capture for ourselves. I've said this a bunch of times publicly, but you know, there's sort of that famous Bill Gates line, which is, you know, you've built a platform where you're able to create more value for the platform, for the third parties, than you capture for yourself. I mean, Shopify, you know, last year did $1.5 billion, but the ecosystem made close to $6 billion last year. And some of these are big companies, but a lot of them are, you know, two, three single person shops that just build apps for Shopify. So we've always sort of took a bit of a more platform approach to building software and to building the product. And now the result of it is that no matter what your use case is, you can get just about 100% product market fit on Shopify, regardless of what are the particular nuances of your business, because our 80% gives you coverage, but the other 20% really customizes it for you. And then as we sort of continued, it became clear that around 2013 that, okay, we're not really in the e-commerce business. We're actually in the commerce business. And then you have to sort of think, okay, what does the future of commerce look like? Is the future of commerce going to be some omni-channel? Is it going to be some sort of combination of online and offline? Our view was, no, actually, it's not going to be that. The future of commerce is going to be retail everywhere. That in the future, unlike the past, the consumer is going to dictate to the retailer, the brand, or the business how they want to purchase. And if a consumer says, I want to buy on Facebook or Instagram, that's the way you have to sell it. And if the consumer says, I want to buy offline in a physical, beautiful, you know, downtown boutique, that's where you have to sell it. And it might be online, and it may be on Pinterest or House or wherever. And so around 2013, our objective changed from building this sort of being the best e-commerce software for small businesses to really just being commerce software. And we began to sort of use the term retail operating system, that what if we were the world's first retail operating system? And then around 2014, 2015 came around, sort of pre-IPO, something else happened, which was dramatic, which was that some of those businesses that started on Shopify at their mom's kitchen table, very, very small businesses in some cases, they grew to be category leaders. They grew to be they were no longer the insurgents. They became the incumbents.
Give us some examples.
Yeah, this is sort of Gymshark, Movement Watches, these type of businesses that simply almost overnight became truly leaders. And Allbirds and Bahamas didn't come until a little bit later. Tommy John, like some of these businesses got really, really big on Shopify really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And the interesting part there, the insight was, if you think about software as an industry generally, what you tend to see is this. If you just take something like email marketing, when you sort of the prosumer starts using the BCC line in email, and then that prosumer becomes a small business, a very small business, a micro business, and they maybe start using something like MailChimp, or they start using Constant Contact, and eventually they may upgrade to ExactTarget, and eventually they may use some sort of like Oracle version of that. But there tends to be a transition or a graduation in software as you get bigger. What we encountered sort of pre-IPO around 2013-14 was that the businesses that had been starting on Shopify, they were growing really, really big and they were not leaving the platform. And so again, there was a new thing to think about. There was a new piece of insight, which is, wait a second, maybe we're not just e-commerce software, we're commerce software, and maybe we're not just for small businesses, but maybe actually larger companies can use this as well. And that really was the formation of Shopify Plus. And Shopify Plus was really just created as a place for the most successful businesses to graduate to as they got really, really big. And that was happening. But then something else happened, which is that a bunch of really large companies, whether it's, you know, brands like Yeezy, or it was Procter & Gamble, or Unilever, and Nestle, or Heinz Ketchup, or Neutrogena, they began to come to Shopify Plus and say, hey, look, we don't want a six-month sales cycle. We don't want to spend $15 million. We just want to get something up right away that's super scalable, that's super beautiful, and we want to have modern technology. And so Shopify Plus became a landing pad for a lot of those companies. And some of them actually, I met Blake from Tom Shoes at a summit. And what Blake said to me was, and funny enough, Andy from Bonobos also said the same thing, that these were sort of version one or sort of the first era, the first gen of DTC brands. And Blake had no choice but to build custom software. So did Bonobos. But what was happening was around 2015, these companies were like, why do I have 300 engineers when I can just use Shopify Plus? And actually, Tom Shuza came over, and Rebecca Minkoff came over, and Steve Madden came over, and Nicole Miller. And so that's a long answer to a very short question, but that sort of does paint the picture of why I think we've been able to innovate is because we're always questioning past assumptions. Are we really e-commerce? What is commerce? Are we really small business? What do small businesses look like? And I think we've been able to do a pretty good job of staying ahead. Lots more to do, but that's sort of how we look at the world.
You mentioned Blake, you mentioned Andy at Bonobos. Like, these are companies that specialize in shoes and pants, not technology. Right. So here we are, like they have to now make that jump to the next level of their software to empower their business. And they certainly aren't going to do it in-house. And if they do, it's going to slow them down tremendously. Whereas with you guys, it sounds like the reason that you kept on innovating, the reason you kept on adding these partner programs and projects and, you know, support system, that ecosystem approach, is because this is the life cycle of, I just never knew that. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, I think the contract we have with, like, not the legal contract, but actually the agreement we have with our merchants, these million stores, is that when you hear something that comes out in commerce, whether it's Facebook announcing shops, or it's Pinterest adding buyable pins, or it's Instagram doing direct purchase right on Instagram, if you're on Shopify, we have a responsibility to make sure that you're able to use that technology. By choosing Shopify, you will always ensure you have the most modern version of whatever commerce is, whether that's Apple Pay or Shopify Pay, or it's Android Pay or for the accelerated checkout, or it's cross-posting on different marketplaces or cross-posting. I mean, we announced a deal a couple weeks ago with Walmart, because walmart.com is now allowing
third parties. I saw that. Congratulations.
Right, which is really cool. Now, most of our stores on Shopify don't necessarily want or need to sell on walmart.com, but there are thousands of stores that absolutely would love to cross-sell their products and their brands on walmart.com. And so 5 years ago or 10 years ago, that would have to be them flying out to Bentonville, Arkansas and meeting a retail buyer. Now they don't have to do that. Now by being on Shopify through the Shopify dashboard, the admin, they can simply activate that channel and get hopefully get approved to cross sell. So that's the covenant we have with them, which is, I think, why you've seen so many folks come over to us. And we wear that responsibility really heavily. That is what I think is what makes us a good company, but it also means that there's a great deal of responsibility when you take that on. And I think that's the reason why some of the biggest brands on the planet trust us.
Shifting gears here a little bit to talk a little bit more about you and a little bit more about, you know, your style of leadership, and both personally and professionally, I'm sure it's felt inside your company as it is outside, but like, you're such a humble dude. You and Tobias are like so kind, so nice, so generous. Like, in all your conversations, one would forget that you're running, you know, a $130 billion company with 6,000 employees. And I want to know, like, you know, do you have like a daily practice? Are you meditating? Like, how, and has this been an active pursuit for you guys to not let, you know, the success of this go to your head? Or is it just sort of your personalities?
I mean, I think building a company like Shopify in Canada, I got to spend a moment on sort of geography, because I think, again, I sort of had a taste of both worlds, you know, born in Canada, but I sort of feel like I spent my formative years in the US, and Canada to me is Canada sort of like America for Europeans, is kind of the best way that I can put it. I know you've spent some time up here in Toronto, yeah, and other places, but there is a little bit of a... one of the best parts of Canada is sort of this modesty that is just in the air, that it is not cool to be boastful. It is not cool to kind of lose yourself in your own, you know, ego. And I think, now, by the way, that's not always a good thing either. Sometimes Canadians generally are overly humble. They don't, you know, our prime minister talks about that Canada needs more swagger. I think that's right. I think we do need more swagger. If I asked you to name five tech companies from Canada, you can name Shopify, and maybe you'd say something like Nortel or BlackBerry, which are both really not around anymore. We tend to be on the acquiring side of the book, not the acquirers, which is because I think there's a little bit of an inferiority complex that exists up here. But I didn't grow up here, and so I have less of that. And Toby grew up in Germany, so he has less of that also. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, keeping our focus, I think the best thing that certainly Toby and I would both agree on is our partners, our wives, our life partners have been incredibly instrumental in that, because I've been with Lindsay since well before Shopify, and Toby has been with Fiona for the same thing. So there is a little bit of there are people around us that hold us accountable. There are some people that call us out on our bullshit when that exists. Similar to you, I know you have a similar dynamic, but my best friends today are still the best friends that I had when I was a kid. And no matter, you know, how well I'm doing or how well the company is doing, they're still going to call me out on my stuff. But we've also, you know, Toby and I started seeing a coach back in 2011, or I would say, on a recommendation of a mutual friend. And we ended up loving coaching so much that we ended up hiring the coach full time. His name is Cam. And then he came into Shopify and we asked him to build a coaching practice. And so there are 16 or so full-time coaches on staff at Shopify. And we had a coach on staff before we had a CMO, I think even before we had a CFO potentially. So that sort of performance management, growth, leadership growth thing is sort of embedded in our culture. But it's not the type of place where, you know, walking around with a big head and walking around immodest gets you very far. In fact, I think the antibodies at Shopify sort of reject those things. They sort of push you out. And we don't necessarily, people have come into our company that have had ridiculously impressive backgrounds and CVs and have built huge companies and made tons of money. And it doesn't always work out because sometimes they simply, they don't come in necessarily with the right curiosity. They don't come in as an anthropologist who kind of needs to look at Shopify and understand it before they can have an impact. And then on the sort of mental health side of things, frankly, it's been tough for me. I'm a, Tim Ferriss calls me a power extrovert. And I think that's probably accurate. I love being around people. That's where I get my energy on almost every Friday night. You can find my wife and I hosting, Shabbat dinners at our home with tons and tons of friends. And that's just kind of how we've always lived. And it's been, I've had anxiety since I was a kid. I feel like my anxiety has been accelerated far more since sort of COVID hit. And I've just sort of been doubling down on the things that keep me grounded. And probably the most important thing, other than just a daily 10-minute insight timer mindfulness practice, has been time with the kids. I have two daughters. Bailey's 4 and Zoe's 1.5. And I've rescheduled my life. And so I start my day, walking the dog with the girls. I finish my day walking with the whole family. I've tried to be very intentional about how to kind of make this all work, because the truth is I've been really lonely. I've been more lonely in the last 3 months than I have, any time I can remember. But I'm also talking, the reason that I'm okay with talking about it on your podcast, Jeff, is that I think it's important that we all kind of share not just the highlight reels of what's going on, but also those tough days. Because I think there's a little bit of bravado that happens, particularly in tech. And it's a little bit easier to be outside of the valley and outside of the States, but there's a bit of bravado that happens. And not every day I'm feeling my best. That's kind of how we do it. And I think the other thing is, taking you back to Summit for a second, one of the reasons that I went to Summit was surround myself with people that were better, smarter, faster than I was. And that's what Summit did for me for many, many years. It allowed me to sit at a table and meet ask, who are you? What do you do? I'm Shep. Oh, are you the Superman? Yes. Just having conversations like that are just so mind blowing. I remember meeting Robin Arzon at one of the Summit at Seas before Peloton had blown up, and just hearing her story, her transition from law into, basically helping to curate a curriculum for this small company called Peloton. That I think is so valuable. And I think a lot of us, despite my saying that my best friends are still the best friends I had since I was a kid, my network, the people that I speak to on a daily basis, sort of these mentors in my life, one of them is the best father I've ever met. And I want to emulate the way he is a father. He's actually not very good at many other things, which he would admit to, but he's just the world's greatest dad. I have another friend who just really understands really family dynamics really well, particularly when money's involved. And I really want to emulate the way he structured his family. And another one is just the most amazing, philanthropist and loves to give his time and his money to charities and make a real impact. And so I've been able to curate a group of sort of mentors that I kind of swap in and out depending on what I'm focused on, who are so much better than I am at those things. And that really helps.
I had a friend who gave me this piece of advice, and he was a very successful real estate developer, and he had retired in his late 30s to spend time with his family and his friends. And he got presented this amazing opportunity to do this development that he had dreamed of. And so he was coming back out of retirement and raise more money and was building the team and getting excited. And his wife pulled him aside and was just like, "Hey man, just so you know, no one that you love the most or that loves you the most will care or will love you any more or less based on your success or failure this venture." Right. And so having people in your life that aren't measuring you by that yardstick is just so important. And I think for you guys, I don't even know if you ever built that. A lot of us just have that, around us, and you desire it. At least I did. I had, an ego. I wanted to feel special or valuable or successful or any of those. They're looked at that way, you know, in my 20s, of course. And so
that's a tough thing, right? Like it's tough. And you know, I grew up with two very loving parents, parents that also believed I can do anything. And I'm not sure coddling is the right word, but I was sort of always, I was really lucky that I had very supportive people around me. The problem was, like most of us, when, you know, in my early 20s, I kind of thought I knew what I was doing. I kind of thought, oh, I built this t-shirt business. I made a little bit of money and I did this other thing and I made some, you know, I got into law school and I did all these things and it was really cool. That's the value of surrounding yourself with people that are truly better than you in a whole bunch of different categories, because you begin to, it's like, you know, we use the metaphor of boxes at Shopify, that there's sort of a series of boxes. At the bottom of every box, you're shaky, you're uncertain, things are not necessarily, you're not confident. And then eventually you get to the top of that next box, that box. And that's where you begin to get that swagger, you begin to get confident, maybe even cocky. If you have people around you that reach their hand down and then bring you into that next box, even though the bottom of the next box, you're going to be incredibly shaky, that is super valuable. And I think that is the value of having, you know, a tribe or a community around you to kind of help you with that process. But I got to tell you, like my biggest challenge when I first joined Shopify wasn't the work, it wasn't the company, it was myself. It was that I wasn't self-aware. I didn't necessarily have this insatiable growth mentality or this curiosity. I felt like whatever I'd done, I was able to, you know, I was proud of that, but I thought that mattered. And I certainly did not have this idea that I'm going to have to requalify for the things that I currently have professionally every single year. And I got to tell you, I'm a lot happier now. I'm a lot more mindful now. My relationships are richer now. And I'm a better human being now than I was then. And the way it manifested itself was in the early days, remember not wanting to hire anyone better than me, because I thought that if I hired someone better than me, it meant that I was less valuable or less valued. And it just, that's the furthest thing from the truth now. Like everyone who I've hired is so much better than me, and that makes me better. And that makes me very proud. The journey's been great.
Art of the Hustle will be right back after this short break.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm curious, you know, for you now, what do you still do too much of?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I probably spend too much. So it's funny, if you sort of think about like work as being kind of three different categories, sort of in the weeds, kind of the middle work, and then sort of up top is kind of the large strategy stuff. I tend to kind of operate in either the bottom or the top. I tend not to do the middle stuff. And I probably should be a little more balanced, but I do get into the weeds sometimes on things that I care a lot about. There are particular areas of Shopify that I'm so, maybe to the detriment of the group and maybe the detriment of me, I'm overly attached to, and I need folks to basically say, hey, look, I got this. And it's not to say, like, I know that's a sort of prototypical, you know, thing where I'm too focused. None of that crap. I just sometimes I get too far into the weeds on something that I sort of forget the bigger picture. And that's sort of where curating my calendar in a way that actually allows me to have the highest impact, that I think is really important. But one thing that I did do, I brought some more things in my life that are just fun for me. I still take calls with certain merchants that are thinking of migrating over or that are thinking of launching on Shopify. Because what I realized was there are certain things I don't need to be involved in everything, because there's no way to run a company at our scale. If you're involved in too many things, I become a bottleneck. I never want to be a bottleneck. But there are some things that are fun for me. And the things that are, I believe that we all need to kind of figure out what those things are. For you, maybe it's something as simple as the music at an event for Summit. And you may be like, I know we have like the greatest music producers like on retainer, on standby, like the most famous, you know, I think you guys basically have like Questlove on retainer at Summit, which is amazing. But sometimes I bet you say, like, you know, I like let Jeff just deal with this because I just want to do this. I think it's important to remain, to have some fun and not lose that sense of fun and so I allow myself the opportunity or the freedom to kind of get into the weeds sometimes, but I think I probably do it too much.
My worry is like there's the podcast called The Art of the Hustle, and that is such like a, you know, 20s mentality for me, right? Where it's like you hustle in terms of like the language that we're using to describe it. And there's a limitation to what that can get you, right? And then you have to gain wisdom not from your experiences, but ideally from reflection. And I have an issue where I'll just end up scheduling my days so packed so repeatedly and not really save time for reflection when I'm in like a work mindset. And so that's what I'm trying to get more of for myself. And that leads me to my next question for you. You know, I want to know, what do you want more of right now?
Yeah, I'm fairly type A. And I find, and I'm sort of incredibly goal oriented. I'm trying to look for things right now that I actually can just be at. So, I started running 2 years ago. I'd always wanted to run, never figured out a way to run. I was always sore. Like I can cycle for, you know, 100 and 200 K, but I was never able to run. So I got a coach and began to start thinking about running and running technique. And then of course that always leads to the next stage, which is, okay, when are we going to run a half marathon or when are we going to run a marathon? It's just like, I feel like I'm always in conversations with sort of my running group about that particular thing. And I actually decided to sit out and said, hey, I'm not going to run a half marathon. I don't want to run a marathon. I just want to enjoy going for a run. You know, I bought the Garmin watch and I made sure that I was tracking everything on Strava. And I was being a really good type A entrepreneur, and I just started enjoying it less. You know, same thing with cooking. I got really into cooking a couple of years ago. My wife is a food entrepreneur. She also, you know, has been a fairly well-known blogger in the Canadian food scene for a long time. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to cook. And then it was a matter of like, I'm going to cook and I'm going to plate it in a particular way that just looks so amazing. And I stopped enjoying So in the same way that I stopped enjoying running once I started to think about the marathon or half marathon, I stopped enjoying cooking when I sort of felt that I'm doing it for the destination. And some things I just want to enjoy the journey of. I know that sounds, you know, cliche, but some things, like, I just want to go out for a run sometimes. And if I run for 10 minutes or 30 minutes, if I listen to music or a podcast, whatever it is, I just want to enjoy that. And I'm not good at that. I'm actually really bad at that. And so I'm intentionally now saying, I'm going to cook, and like, if it looks great, whatever. If it doesn't look great, that's okay too. It'll be delicious and I'm going to enjoy the process and my family is going to absolutely love it. Being more mindful about that stuff, I think, is really important. And because everything in my life is basically quantified, whether it's, you know, the stuff I'm doing at the office or it's the stuff that I'm doing, you know, on sort of the investment side or on the philanthropic side, it's all quantifiable. I want to have some stuff that is a little bit more right-brained in my life. And so I'm really struggling to kind of pull back from some of those things as much as possible. But one thing I do want to say, just to comment on the previous comment you made around sort of the art of the hustle, is this. If you actually scroll back through my timeline for like 3 hours and you get to like 2013, you would see basically between 2011, 2013, almost every single tweet that I had ended with hashtag hustle. It was sort of it was a personal philosophy for me. I learned it from Gary Vee, and I'd spent some time understanding his philosophy around, you know, perseverance and just, you know, running through walls at all costs. And it was an interesting kind of life philosophy for me. And actually, Tina Eisenberg, Swiss Miss, who has this great company called Tatley, she actually made me as a gift after sort of seeing this all emerge. She made me a gift business cards that also doubled as a temporary tattoo that said hashtag hustle. And if, again,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I probably gave out those business cards at a bunch of summits. And at some point it became sort of synonymous with Harley, at least at Shopify, that, you know, Harley was kind of this hashtag hustle guy. And one of the things I realized was people began to misinterpret it. And I actually realized that what was happening was people interpreted hashtag hustle as this kind of strange work hard mentality. There was no room for nuance. There was no room for optimization. It was, if you have to get something done and it's going to take 100 phone calls, you do the 100 phone calls. And actually, that's never what I meant. What I meant by it was, you actually figure out who are the three people who are most likely going to lead to an affirmative answer or a yes in the other line, and you call those three people. And so, funny enough, I'm glad you're thinking about sort of the history of the term, because at Shopify, it became something that I actually regretted in introducing to the company. And so, at some point, I almost had a funeral for it at the company. I gave a talk at a town hall, and I said, I'm actually retiring hashtag hustle because it's been misinterpreted, and it's not really just about working hard. It's also about working smart. It's about being strategic about certain things. It's about finding hacks and finding ways to kind of skip the queue. So I thought that was an interesting kind of segue.
And what got you here won't get you there. It's funny, I'm sitting here at my desk in my office talking to you about it, and I have a Memento Mori skull sculpture that says, never put off tomorrow what you can do today. And it's the only words that are looking at me on my desk. And so here I am being like, yeah, man, you know, I really want more reflection. But the mementos, the totems that I have around me are still towards the temple of the hustle.
Yeah, you know what I did? I changed the artifacts in my office. We're not on video now, but if you were to see in my office here, I'm at my house, my artifacts changed from, like, you know, I had like a Morgan Stanley made like the skateboard sort of deal tombstone. We did a fundraise post IPO, and they made me sort of the deal tombstone was actually a skateboard because they knew I skateboarded. And actually, I used to have that up in my office, and I've actually changed it now with actually pictures that my kids have made for me. So really, like, these are like crayon drawings. And honestly, it makes me so much happier to have those in my office as my backdrop than something like these sort of $300 million deal tombstones. So, hey, look, I'm going through what you're going through also, which is that I think we're all trying to figure out how we operate in this new world, how we find time for mindfulness and how we find time for just being. But it's difficult because, you know, to your point, what got you here won't get you there. What got us here is it's very much in our firmware. It's not our prefrontal cortex working. It's our amygdala working in many cases. It's our lizard brain. And for a lot of entrepreneurs that are listening to it, our lizard brain is the reason that we got here. And not entirely, but some parts of it, our desire, our ambition, our work ethic. And so it's very difficult to get to a particular point and say, okay, now I'm going to stop. Now I really want to just double down on my mindfulness practice and my yoga. And I want to make sure that I you know, I'm able to be artsy and I want to be able to live in the moment. And it's just really difficult because we've been sort of, you know, we've had hundreds of years of breeding on this, but also for those entrepreneurs, at some point you were doing everything yourself. And so at some point, just deciding you're not going to do everything yourself, you're going to get out of the details or the weeds. It's just not an easy thing to do sometimes.
Thank you for the time, Harley. I love you. You're incredible. You're such an amazing dude. You're such a like great, great person. And clearly just like it for me, it like you said, you know, coming to Summit and getting to meet people that are brilliant and wonderful people and wonderful entrepreneurs and, you know, learning from them, you know, like you, I was, you know, it was a decade ago. So I was in my early 20s, which means by definition, you pretty much don't know shit. And, you know, for me and for my partners to see what you guys have been able to do and how you carry yourselves and what you value has been really inspiring and really impactful for us. So thanks again for being on the podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. And Harley, man, keep rocking, dude.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.